seems to be true. For music and fiction, it's important to refer to the intermediate relationship between the two. Many musical works were appropriated in literature and vice versa. The relations between fiction and music belong to the intermediate potential of fiction. This makes part of an expanding field commonly referred to as intermediality studies, dealing with inter-art relations. The term intermediality refers to the relationship between media, and it's used to describe a huge range of cultural phenomena which involve more than one medium. This talk is focused on the BBC and a strand of British music, the music hall, which is used interchangeably in this paper with the word variety. This talk starts with the delineation of the development of variety on the BBC, continues with the attendant problems between the variety interests and the BBC, and ends with the perception of the BBC variety programs. Now, back to the BBC, and I'll say that since its inception in 1922, the BBC made music a major aspect of its programming. The BBC started by offering what was considered as serious music with the major purpose of uplifting the audience. However, the late 1920s and early 1930s saw the adoption of variety programs, commonly classified as common culture. The BBC started in 1930 a revue and vaudeville section, which introduced programs like Songs from the Shows in 1931 and the Music Hall in 1932. These series were under the director of variety, Eric Mashwitz, and John Watt, the head of the revue and vaudeville section. So they were working together. Mashwitz pioneered new shows like In Town Tonight, and new stars and performers made their way thanks to Mashwitz, like Elsie and Doris Waters. The BBC established a theatre at St. George's Hall in 1933, I think it's in West London, with a variety orchestra which was used for live broadcasts. Variety broadcasts featured comic singers, satirists, and sometimes impersonators, and these broadcasts were live, and they were in the form of sketches and studio serials. The BBC variety broadcasting saw a steady growth, and in fact, the amount of variety broadcasts almost trebled between 1933 and 1939. And it started with 16 hours a month in 1933 and reached 49 hours in 1939. And programs like Palace of Varieties and Bandwagon attracted large audiences. Now, the establishment of a BBC variety department was a major turn in the history of the BBC. It signaled a change in Reith's policy and led to controversy on the growing commercialization of the BBC programming, especially as variety was considered vulgar and debasing. And of course, this went against the mission of the BBC, which supposedly should preserve radio from the commercialism infecting the popular press and cinema, and instead should promote higher values. Variety broadcasts were part of an attempt to counter the popularity of European radio stations, and they were adopted despite the fact that the BBC was considered as a vanguard against low taste. However, to better understand the association between variety and commercialization and variety and common culture, it's important to give a brief summary of the evolution of the music hall into variety and why this working class art is considered vulgar. And here, I'll move to the second section of this talk, which is related to the history of variety. Now, the music hall is, now, this part has to do with the history of the music hall. It's a just brief, just briefs you on this type of music and the way it emerged. So it's a Victorian institution which developed as a culture of consolation that kept the Victorian working man happy, and that alleviated political and social impotence. And that was why, and here I'm quoting Professor Mullen, the worker felt at home, and the term People's Palace was not used without a reason. According to Peter Bailey, the music hall as an art was focused on the booze, romantic adventure, marriage, mothers-in-laws, and seaside holidays. And it demonstrates a recurrent emphasis on the domestic and the everyday. The music hall was criticized by the advocates of improving entertainment, or what was referred to as rational entertainment, because of the rowdy behavior of the audience and the moral panics of reliance on sexual innuendos for comics. This led to attempts by social reformers to abolish music halls. So to reduce criticism, music hall managers started to impose a code of conduct on music hall performers in a bid to cleanse the music hall. This was part of what was referred to as an attempt to purify the music hall. And here I'm quoting Brett Bevan. However, they failed, and they failed terribly, because they did not manage to curb the audience's appetite for the double entendre, or in French, le double entendre, and the performer's ability to sidestep managers' bits to introduce more respectability. So they failed. So the managers failed to make the music hall respectable. Now, the heyday of the music hall was roughly between 1890 and 1910. This period saw the change of the music hall from small-scale entertainments controlled by pub owners into a big business functioning under strict rules, commonly known as variety theaters. Now, large halls were constructed to attract pleasure seekers, and this marked the beginning of the commercialization of an institution which was born from below, and in turn entailed the deracination of an art which was purely working class. The commercialization of the music hall would explain the conflicts between the new business owners and the BBC. And this leads us into the third part of this talk, which has to do with variety interests and the BBC. And I'm trying here to show that the broadcasting of the music hall on the BBC was not that easy. The broadcasting of variety on the BBC was not, as mentioned earlier, was a long process. This was a direct consequence, as mentioned earlier, of the capitalization of the music hall, and which was controlled by business owners and the strict rules, which included contracts with music hall performers. Now, these contracts included a clause that forbade broadcast without obtaining the firm's permission. The General Theatres Corporation, it's an amalgamation which owned almost 80% of the music halls in London and the provinces, justified the ban on the grounds that attendance at the variety theatres will be affected by broadcasting. In 1930, for example, when the BBC announced its music hall program, which featured Gracie Fields, a music hall star, the GTC gave consent, but after a series of conferences, and it was explained to Gracie Fields that this concession was made so that not to disappoint the listeners. Similarly, the BBC has to appeal to the GTC to allow Mr. Max Miller, again, a music hall star, to appear in the New Year's Eve program. Even worse, the BBC could not broadcast the Royal Variety performance attended by the King and the Queen at the London Palladium on May the 22nd, 1933. Mr. George Black, director of the production policy of the General Theatres Corporation, the GTC, stated in this context, I have told the BBC that we have no objection to occasional broadcasts of actual performances from one of our London music halls. But with regard to individual artists and the contract, we made it clear that we must retain the right to decide. And here they need to decide whether to allow the music hall stars to appear on the BBC or not. And he says that if the BBC have any suggestions to offer for a compromise, it's for them to offer a compromise. It's for them to I'm quoting George Plank, and he said, it's for them to make the next move. So they were still deciding. The owners of the largest musical circuits, and this is quite important, stipulated an arrangement with the BBC on satisfactory terms. And we'll see these satisfactory terms. And this included a sum of £15,000 a year for their circuits, meaning around £600 million in today's money, and a total annual payment of £60,000, of course, to the music hall owners. That's around £2 million in today's money. Well, that's a huge amount of money. Surprisingly, the BBC agreed to negotiate, but they were not ready to pay. Yeah, so this is important. This conflict led to the cancellation of BBC appointments with variety artists like Max Miller, Miss Nelly Wallace, and others. But at the same time, the BBC started a talent hunt on its own. And this is very important. This was one effective solution the BBC resorted to in its conflict with the GTC, a conflict which received wide coverage in newspapers and was mainly referred to as the BBC versus the GTC war. Now, most of the newspapers used a war register in reference to this conflict. A register which is replete with terms like struggle, dispute, war, deadlock, etc. Now, this is for the conflict. Now, when it comes to the settlement, again, they used war-related terms like truce, armistice, bury the hatchet, etc. This conflict was even described in the Daily Telegraph as a trench warfare. This lexicon proves that the conflict between the BBC and the variety theatre owners was high in stakes, as the BBC adoption, now, if the BBC adoption of the variety artists means the death of the music hall industry. And that was why the variety interests and the music hall owners were not ready to give in. The first breakthrough emerged with the lifting of the ban on variety artists by Sir Oswald Stahl. And then, which gave musicians and contracting with his company the right to appear in some music halls. The agreement included regular broadcasting from the London Coliseum and Alhambra. However, despite the fact that the GTC asked for compensation for the loss inflicted by broadcasting variety, Sir John Reith, the BBC Director General, did not yield to these pressures. And he was quite tactful during these negotiations. His mission was facilitated when Mr. George Black, the managing director of the GTC, broke away from the ban and allowed broadcasts from his theater. So Oswald Stahl, a member of the GTC, decried this agreement. I'm quoting him here. The situation between the BBC and the theaters has been radically altered during the past few weeks, he stated. Variety theater managers ceased to hold together on the question of music broadcasting. Here he adds that their unity, which had continued unimpaired from the inception of the BBC, was irretrievably broken a few months ago. However, this was a temporary agreement rather than a long-term solution, and the war erupted again. The final settlement was reached in July 1933. Colin Ox, the Daily Mail theatre correspondent, announced that the radio versus variety stage war, again, the war terms are still there, the radio versus variety stage war that has broken out at various times during the year can now be said to have ended. Under the new arrangement, Mr. George Black, managing director of the GTC, was to present the variety show on the BBC starting from September 1934. He would be in charge of the production of the George Black Hour and will himself announce the items at the microphone. This radio show was with artists and the contracting with his company. Colin Ox, as mentioned earlier, a theatre correspondent, stated, now the BBC is burying the George Black hatchet forever, an interment which augurs well for the variety profession as a whole. At the end of the war between the BBC and the GTC, it's important to explore the perception of the BBC variety programs And this leads us into the last part of this talk. So it was a long process. It was described as war, a trench warfare. So it's good to have an idea about the perception, how these programs were perceived by the BBC audience. The broadcasting of variety on BBC radio was highly controversial, and perception were polarized. Variety hours were considered the most popular, but at the same time, the most criticized. On the one hand, BBC variety was considered a source of comfort, especially for workers. In this context, the Times wrote, "The laborer trudging homeward in a winter dusk, the music lover cut off from concerts in Manor House, and the gay young man whose fondness for a good time has persuaded his family to remove him from the destruction of a capital city are all supposed to find in the programs sent out from Broadcasting House an antidote to isolation." At the same time, the BBC variety hours were described as refreshing and rollicking. Listeners waited impatiently for artists like Mr. Nelson Keys and Mr. Arthur Marshall to come back and be funny again. Others welcomed the two Leslies as a source of fun and gusto. The combination of the BBC orchestra and a comedian was considered an association of good music and good fun. One listener referred to variety broadcasts as bringing some juicy brain waves. This was mentioned in a context when the BBC wanted to cut its entertainment expenses, and the people planning these cuts were describing the BBC killjoys. And I think they are many these days, they are still there. On the other hand, variety programs were criticized. And this is the other side of the coin. Grace Harvey, organist and music writer, decried the leveling of the music and the absence of enjoyment of the comic or the other variety turns. Variety on the air was not considered a source of fun, as it never gets the Getty it needs, as one listener put it. When the music hall was broadcast on the ether, it was left, according to music hall fans, without its glitter and gleam. In fact, the bodily expression of a humor and miming, which are major aspects of the music hall, were missing. In this way, the wireless led to the loss of what was considered in the listener as the kinship or the intimacy between the music hall artist and his audience. This was a major issue, especially for comedians like George Robey, who depended on facial expression and the visual interplay with the audience. In a similar vein, and in several letters to editors, whether to the listener, the Times, the Daily Mail, or to the Daily Mail, many listeners complained about the quality of variety broadcasts. The variety broadcasts have been appealing, wrote one listener to the Daily Mail. Another listener pointed to the fact that the frantic enthusiasm, another listener claimed that the frantic enthusiasm of the BBC studio audience is not shared by the fireside audience. Others referred to the stale jokes, which they thought were more than 25 years old. The variety department work of the BBC needs thoroughly overhauling, wrote another listener. Only people who know how to sing and speak should be allowed to broadcast, and there should be some attempts at originality, protested another. Other listeners complained that the BBC was running its variety programs on the cheapy. The millions of the I'm quoting the Daily Mail. The millions of listeners have the right to be consulted, as they pay, and they may possibly object to having immature or second-rate talent inflicted upon them. These complaints emanated mainly from the strict code of conduct imposed by the BBC on variety artists in its attempt to cleanse the music hall. The BBC controlled the selection of the songs and drama. This is an example of censorship. At the same time, the BBC restrictions on materials hampered the broadcast of what was considered as outspoken humor. This affected the performance of music hall artists like Harry Ladder, who was criticized for trying to be puritanical, and listeners advised him to stop doing so. This was a major issue for musical artists who were banned in case they fall into vulgarity and double entendre. Max Miller, for example, was banned by the BBC for 5 years, and these incidents happened with other musical artists as well. The BBC monitored scripts, and if artists do without them, then they would be banned. Listeners complained that they were deprived of the better part of a conventional unity of entertainment. Others were disappointed with the BBC variety. "I wish I were amused by the BBC variety programs," stated one listener. "I like music halls, comic songs, and funny men. I would go anywhere to see Mr. George Robey. I switch on eagerly when I see variety in the Radio Times, and I'm almost invariably disappointed and bored," he stated. Variety artists found it difficult to be funny on the air as expected by the BBC, and the director of productions complained that too many of the plays written for the ether are about serious things, and that was why the BBC could not sustain laughter on the air. And especially by banning vulgarity, which was the source of most of the music hall jokes, and this in turn affected the quality of variety on the BBC. In comparison with the old music hall. Other listeners complained that the BBC failed to amuse them, and they stated that they fail because they are bloodless and because they so completely lack any kind of gaiety. Gay tunes and gay personality are essential if variety on the wireless is to have an appeal. However, despite all these issues, the BBC radio helped variety theaters survive the 30s. The BBC radio provided new employment opportunities for many of the displaced artists of the halls. The wireless offered, according to Asa Briggs, a means of advancement to local comedians who were conscious of the pressure of the cinema on their livelihood. And these were engaged in small, intimate audiences, meaning they were in provincial after-dinner shows or in summer holidays in seaside results. However, the post-World War II era saw the virtual end of the traditional music hall, and this was one of the consequences of the radio. The audiences stayed away in droves. They left the comic to their own way, and further cinemas came into being. This was a continuation of a trend which started at the turn of the century and which was affecting popular entertainment. According to Asa Briggs, what was amateur entertainment changed into professional entertainment. The Daily Mail deplored the death of the old music hall. And here, this is what was written in the Daily Mail. "The music hall has been supplanted in popular esteem by cinemas, the wireless, and reviews. And the very spirit which animated it seems to have vanished forever. But it's sad to think that the music hall, which produced so much genuine and so much harmless amusement, should have fallen upon such evil days. The demise of the music hall accentuated with the development of the cinema and the radio and finally TV." So just to sum up, the road to variety was very long. It was not easy to settle the conflict with the variety interests. Second conclusion, Sir John Reith or the BBC in general were very tactful when it comes to the settlement of the dispute or the war with the variety or the music hall owners. But another point, the BBC gave variety a new lease of life at the turn of the century when the music hall was declining and even the variety theaters were declining as well. And the last point is that it's true that it gave the music hall a new lease of life, but at the same time, after some time, meaning especially with the emergence of new professional entertainment, the music hall, the radio, could have spelled the death knell of the music hall. Thank you very much. And now, I think I have 3 minutes.
Yes, absolutely. And I have the I have the technology.
Yeah, so it's on my, it's night here.
I've got
so
it. I've got it here, Mohammed. I've got it here for you. Okay? Are you ready?
Okay, go on. Roaming in the Globe.
I've seen lots of bonny lassies on my travels wide, but my heart is set for new on bonny Kate McBride. Although I'm no a fella that will throw a word away, I'm surprised sometimes myself at all I've got to say. Roaming in the gloaming on the bonny banks of Clyde, roaming in the gloaming with my lassie by my side. When the sun has gone to rest, that's the time that we love best. Oh, it's lovely roaming in the gloaming, roaming in the gloaming on the bonny banks of Clyde, roaming in the gloaming with my lassie by my side. When the sun has gone to rest, that's the time that we love best. Oh, it's lovely roaming in the gloaming.
Thank you very much, Muhammad. Thank you very much. That Harry Lauder, Roaming in the Gloaming. So an example. Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Muhammad. That was absolutely fascinating. And so I see Muhammad really brought up three big questions there. First of all, the inside part, the symbolic economy of show business. How can it work when it moves onto the airways from the stage? And so all this side of, you know, how can you get that excitement, that enchantment of everyday life from one form to another? Secondly, he showed the importance of competition, how earlier the press, later the record companies, but here the theatre companies were worried about the material going stale if it was on the broadcast on the radio. Nobody will come to the music hall if they can listen to it on the radio. All this kind of worries, which will continue for a long time. The conflicts with the record companies will go on through the 40s, 50s and 60s. And finally, this question of high culture and popular culture, and how, to some extent, the BBC was not going to allow too much space for working class culture. And I was reading just the other day an example which I wanted to mention, because we sometimes get the impression that in the 30s, the BBC didn't like popular culture, but then that all changed. However, in the 1980s, in 1983, Radio 3, which is classical music, got 2% of listenership. And Radio 1, which was popular music, got 28%. However, the annual budget was £13 million for the 28% listening to Radio 1 and £28 million for the 2% listening to Radio 3. So I just wanted to add that in. This was to give you time to think of questions, I'm hoping. Now, I said write them in the chat, but actually let's have a go. Let's have a go at you. I have allowed you to open your microphones if you like. So if you have a question and you wish to use your microphone, open your microphone, say who you are, because we now have 78 people here, and then ask your question, if you will, please.